Support for this podcast comes from Facebook. Running a business is challenging in 2020. That's why many small business owners are turning to Facebook tools. Owners like Stasha Harris, founder of the Brooklyn hair studio Magic Fingers. When she couldn't meet clients in person, she held braiding tutorials over Instagram Live for thousands of her followers. Stasha kept going, even when the rest of the world stopped. Connect to the customers you're looking for with Facebook tools. Visit facebook.com/smallbusiness.
Welcome to The John Roa Show, a production of iHeartRadio and Roa Media Works. This is Leading from Home, a special limited series where I'll be checking in with leaders and entrepreneurs from across the country on how they're dealing with the coronavirus pandemic. It's Friday, April 17th, 37 days since the pandemic began. If there's been one consistency in every conversation I've had with leaders so far, it's that the world is not going to be the same after the coronavirus. Whether that's positive or negative is kind of still to be determined. But what's really interesting, and I've mentioned it a couple times so far, is the opportunity for innovation. The market is going to be ripe for ideas that take advantage of our new landscape. Are there going to be co-working spaces created that are more purpose-built for flexible working environments, or even social distance working? Will we adopt technology or create new technology that scans temperature in public places or like airports, like they currently do in parts of Asia, to try to get ahead of upcoming infectious diseases? Will social networks adapt to focus more on health and safety? Who will be the next Zoom? Who will jump on the lack of innovation that we've had around virtual working and the tools that are going to become staples in the new environment? Entrepreneurs, this is a call to action that we only get once every decade or so. So go take advantage of it. Today, I'll be speaking with Rich Antaniello, the CEO and founder of Complex Networks. Complex runs video-first brands that cater to the young millennial and Gen Z markets. They also make my favorite online show, Hot Ones, that I almost got Rich to promise to get me onto. He's got some amazing insights on how he perceives the challenges and opportunities during a crisis like this, and some surprising predictions on what's to come next. So I want to ask what you're up to, because you are the CEO of a extremely impactful global media company that's now under the umbrella of far larger companies than what you were 20 years ago when you got started in all this.
And that's an understatement.
And it's been, you know, I've obviously known about Complex and your products and your shows and your name for a long time, and it's great to finally talk to you. But I've really dug in with my producers over the weekend to learn more, and it's remarkable what you guys have done, that the pivots, the tangents, the acquiescing to modern, you know, trends and brands and all these different things that you've done.
Well, I'm gonna jump in there before you even get to your question, because it might alter the way you ask it. I'm gonna tweak your statement a little bit, because I don't believe we've ever acquiesced to the consumer. The same way we start the conversations and others react to it, because we don't really do news reporting as much as we do opinion and actually try and set the conversation and frame it. Mm-hmm. We've done the same thing with our products. By the way, until we launched ComplexCon 5 years ago, no brand was out there doing cons. My point is, we didn't acquiesce to the desires of the consumer. We've created the correct extensions that realize demand that was there maybe invisibly for others,
which is even better.
Yeah,
and even more impressive.
It's defining a category rather than chasing it.
And you've done that in spite of probably the majority of the competitors aiming to do the same thing, having failed in the meantime.
With a lot less capital.
With a lot less, right. And you've been scrappy, and you've been in it kind of feels like startup mode for most of your existence in terms of the mindset. Obviously,
by the way, nobody realizes that. You've just nailed. That's exactly it. We wouldn't be where we are if we ever turned the page on that as a behavior.
Right.
You just nailed something very important. Most people don't even understand.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've been an entrepreneur for 20 years now. And so I know it's funny, because it makes me feel, you know, both, you know, somewhat young and somewhat old all at the same time. And I feel even older when I look at Complex and I look at your market and stuff. And I'm like, I'm looking at sneakers and TikTok videos and I'm like, I don't understand any of this shit. It makes me feel even older.
Dude, I got news for you. I guarantee you I'm older than you are. How old are you?
I'm 36.
Right. Dude, yeah. I'm 33% older than you. I'm 48.
Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. So like, I love what you're doing and you're in the driver's seat of this thing and you've been through a lot. You've had to kick ass and take names for a long time. You've had to endure some pretty tough times too. The financial crisis, you came in early 2000s in a crazy time in media and tech. And now you're leading through a global pandemic, which is just another piece that I'm sure is going to go down in the biography that I'm sure you'll write one day. So I'm going to start there. How do you see this event in kind of your story and Complex's story? How are you handling all of this from home? And what insights have you kind of gained through the last, 30, 45 days of running this company?
That's a big question, right? Let's isolate the pandemic first, right? And I think one of the biggest issues here is, unlike everything else we've battled, and let's just use the 08 financial crisis. Not that it's a one for one, but just because of the speed at which it hit and then the depth and level of impact.
Mm-hmm.
But here was the difference is that happened and we knew exactly how to deal with it. It wasn't going to be easy. You had to go get capital or recapitalize your business, but it happened and it was over. It was an end point. What's different this time is we don't know when we're going to go back to work.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what going back to work looks like. We don't know what going back to production looks like. We don't know what kind of demand, irrespective of the increased audiences we're enjoying. We don't know what the demand is going to be on the advertising component of that or the event component.
Mm-hmm.
If this goes into June or July, what effect is that going to have on a disproportionate amount of our audience, which is lower, younger millennials, older Gen Z people, what effect is that going to have on their disposable income?
Right.
And because of the consumerism aspect of our business, not that we're going to change the topics we cover, but do we change the manner in which we cover them?
Sure.
And by the way, I'm not trying to not answer your question, but I'm trying to say is because of the complete amount of uncertainty of the ending of the actual pandemic itself, we don't know the impact, both the depth or the breadth or the timing of the recovery either.
The pandemic aside is stage one, right? And then we're going to have the economic, the start of the economic comeback, the long-term tail of that, which could affect us for years like 08. So it's a multi-stage approach, I'm sure you're thinking about.
And that's my point is a lot of what we're thinking about, there's the balance and the challenge of the triage of getting through this, right? Being able to continuously operate. That's the emergency room orientation side of what we're doing, which I think a lot of people are exclusively doing as businesses. And that's mm-hmm. the biggest mistake you can make. But we're asking ourselves, once we do go back to work, once we are able to film studio shows again or other things like that, how does that change? How does the consumer change? How does the content that they're looking to change become? Like, and here's a perfect case example is right now, we have several sneaker shows and a lot of those shows are about $1,500, $2,000, $3,000, $5,000 pairs of sneakers. Those shows are really important and sneakers will always be important as a topic to these kids, but how many will be able to just want to look at a celebrity flossing through his closet? Well, what is the iteration? Like, do we now go to the designers of this that are now rebuilding their individual brands or their individual design studios and make, and is the narrative switching from purchasing the sneakers from a consumer perspective? Does it switch to us telling the story of how people, the business story of how people recalibrate their brands and rebuild? And does that become now part of our foundational content? Because a lot of the people that might have been purchasing those sneakers might be looking for new and different jobs. and now we can also give them a path forward as well and kill several birds with one stone. And that might be, forget about being tone deaf or not tone deaf. How about being on point from what the orientation of the of entertainment content and service-oriented content and that right mix?
Now, does that feel to you as opportunistic or does that feel to you as reactive? Insofar as, are you saying, like we can't do what we want to do, so we're going to adapt? Or are you saying, wow, we're actually seeing a way to do something better than we would have done before?
No, I think it's our responsibility. If we are the leading youth culture brand, then we should be leading them with what the right messaging and right mix of content is. And if we believe that this is going to be a disproportionately economic dislocation for the millennial and the Gen Z audience from a workplace perspective, then we should be there showing them a path forward. That's our responsibility. It's not an opportunity, and it's definitely not a reaction, but that's our responsibility to be a participant to bring them forward. Like we were built by the community. We got to give back to the community. And that's the way we look at it.
Super interesting perspective. Similar to the one that I heard from Stephen Galanis last week here on the podcast, the CEO of Cameo, because obviously he has a brand new media-centric business, and he was talking about the responsibility that he sees to adapt his business for the times and the optimizations that he's finding in the meantime. And that consistent theme amongst entrepreneurs, I think, is fascinating to not...
Well, I mean, look, we are foundationally... I think you have to be, everybody's like, oh, you have to be crazy to be an entrepreneur. Yes, that's a minimum viable personality trait. But even more so, you have to be inarguably, you have to have the ability to be the most optimistic person during the darkest of times.
Right.
If you don't have that ability, I don't believe you can actually be a successful entrepreneur.
I agree. 100% I agree. See if you agree here, because there's a unflappable optimism, but there's also a sense of over-realism as well. Is that I think we're sometimes confused or mislabeled as dreamers. At least a lot of people I know aren't necessarily dreamers who are looking out, you know, 20 years from now or thinking about the future in the dreamer's light. It's more, I think it's more tangible, and I think it's more realistic.
I couldn't agree with you more. Let me throw something out to you. It's very interesting you say that. I'm not talking about blind optimism. I'm not talking about rah-rah. I'm talking about literally, like, I say this all the time, and I just don't think a lot of people think about it. I chose going into being a builder of a company, an entrepreneur, versus a corporate executive at a larger scale company, because I believe that building a company, you have a ton more ambiguity than anything else in the world.
Right.
And my viewpoint is 95% of people see ambiguity and they use it as an excuse to fail. The 5% look at ambiguity, the entrepreneurs, the quote unquote dreamers you were talking about before, go, oh my God, there's a million different ways to win. And I'll take the 5% on that and the advantage that most people get paralyzed by ambiguity as the greatest opportunity to go win.
Right.
And information is everywhere and education is everywhere. And, you know, previously IQ was the, just so disproportionately the determining factor of people being able to raise capital and win or not win as a business. As information became more ubiquitous, you want to show me really successful entrepreneurs. It's ones that have a massive balance between IQ, like the analysis, the way to look at things and think about things on a thought process, and a very high EQ.
Sure.
Like, and that emotional quotient, being able to inspire and communicate that to the staff in a very simple way so that the execution can be super high level. A lot of the previous earlier stage entrepreneurs that were very successful were 95% IQ, 5% EQ.
Right.
I'm finding more and more of these entrepreneurs
especially
being a balance
tech.
But now everywhere, I'm finding right. The balance is people who are EQ and IQ.
Of course, 100%. How is this pandemic affecting you personally as a leader, as a CEO, as husband and father? What is your life like and how is it different than it was 6 weeks ago?
How about we just go, how is it not different? Because that's different. A shorter list.
Right.
Look, it's different in every way, right? You know, I'm not even living in New York City. We're out at we have a small place out at the North Fork of Long Island. You know, my kids are learning from home. The biggest thing for me that's different and challenging is not being able to look my employees in the eye and connect with them. And I don't mean just the human connection, but like, you know, those amazing, fun brainstorming sessions where sparks happen, working through things together on a physical basis as well is to me something that is difficult to give up.
Right.
The challenge for me is we don't know truly how people are feeling emotionally. That to me is the big question mark.
Right.
My staff has reacted so well with being able to be incredibly creative, incredibly innovative, you know, grinding away, and it's awesome. But are they burning themselves out? Are they feeling alone? Are they feeling accomplished?
Right.
Are they feeling as big a part of a team? And I know some people are asking those questions. I hope more are. I hope people don't take that for granted, because I know we're not. And virtual happy hours will only go so far in helping that.
Sure, right.
I think there's a lot of emotional challenges and emotional scarring that is going to come from this that will come out later that most people are just not discussing quite yet.
Yeah, and I think the emotional component is always overlooked, especially during an event that is somewhat of a physical manifestation, right? It's a physical virus. People are dying. There's hospitals. And I think that we're quickly overlooking the emotional and mental component and toll that this kind of epidemic or pandemic can have on people. And, you know, there's been some interesting conversations that I've had across the board with leaders in every category, from small business owners to McVay, the coach of the Rams. And the one thing that everyone agrees on is that no business will be the same after this. The one place that people are separate on is one of the most interesting pieces to me, which is some leaders have said that this has told them that their in-person environment and offices might not be as important as they thought. Like Stephen from Cambia.
That's not even up for debate.
Okay. Let me hear your thoughts.
And I don't mean from an efficiency valuation perspective. Like, I think a lot of people are realizing how massively productive people can be when they're not forced to be very rigid about their hours, very rigid about commuting into places. We're rethinking what flex hours might be, what type of rotational, like kind of 50-50 staffing perspective might be, and that less about reducing our real estate costs, more about improving the emotional support. And I feel like if people have the ability to liaison, but then can take back more control of their time and their own lives, I think there might be a massive upside that comes from this. And that is something we are very open to. We don't hold on to things. We're not very romantic about how anybody else does it or how even we did it in the past.
Mm-hmm.
We're always looking to go, is there a better way that's smarter? Sometimes more efficient, but sometimes just value added to our people and our end consumers.
Which is a great attitude from a leadership perspective. I think people do get too used to their current circumstance and they're too inflexible to change or pivot or twist during crazy times. And I think the leaders that are willing
to do it.
Yeah. I mean,
that's time to do it.
100%. And that's been a theme I've been hearing from a lot of people on just how opportunistic they are being during this time. And you guys are under obviously a huge company now with Hearst, and I think your fourth year of doing that. How do you think this would be different if this had happened in 2015 when you were still an independent company?
Whew, that's a really good question. You know, look, we were consistently a profitable venture. We didn't have a massive balance sheet, and we had really AAA investors behind us in like Excel Partners and Austin Ventures.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, we would have had a backstop if we needed one beyond our own balance sheet. But now, obviously, having some corporate players and their belief in us as a company and their level of support, I cannot say enough about either one of them. I mean, instead of asking things of us, they've been, what can we do for you? Hmm. And that is very rare.
I was going to say.
it's a real testament to the quality of the companies and the qualities of the individuals at the top of those companies that we're dealing with. The discipline that we ran our business in still would have given us more options, even pre-exiting. You know, I wrote something the other day on Twitter where I was like, show me a real business and I'll show you somebody has its brand plus brains plus balance sheet equals a real business.
Right.
And what's interesting is that third component, the balance sheet, up until a couple of weeks ago, that was not really a worry for a lot of people for some reason. and I have no idea why.
Which sounds ridiculous to say out loud, right? We're talking about...
Well, not so much anymore. Huh?
I know, but I'm saying that this seemingly wasn't a big deal to people is a ridiculous statement. Like, these are businesses, right? I mean, what is one of the core components of a business? Should we think be a healthy balance sheet? And that, to your point, seems to have just gone by the wayside.
It's a little scary. Way down the road, I think a very large positive intangible, hopefully not on a trend basis, but on a permanent cultural shift, will be the return of financial discipline.
I like that.
And real business acumen. I hope the pendulum doesn't swing exclusively to efficiencies and EBITDA.
Right.
But a nice balance of investment and EBITDA.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what happens next. And, you know, I think with any correction that you're going to have a big chunk of positive outcomes and attributes, you're going to have some highly negative ones, right? I think you're going to see some ugliness form when people are desperate and people are kind of scratching to survive in the back of something this drastic. I go back to what it would have been like to run a company if I was in a driver's seat right now, and it would have been fucking brutal. I mean, every time I talk to someone like yourself and my other guests for the last couple of weeks, it just strikes me of how difficult this is, way past what's obvious, right? Anybody could say, oh, being a CEO of a company during a crisis, of course that's difficult. But just, I mean, this is complete next level. And like, I'm not even running a company and I'm getting like the anxiety as if I am, you know what I mean?
Because
this is the first time
I can feel
how hard that is.
Well, you know what you're remembering? Is I say this all the time when I have like senior executives who are like looking to get promoted, and I always sit down with them and I'm like, be careful what you ask for. They're like, what do you mean? And I'm here's what I mean is you make a wrong decision and you might miss your goals or your numbers, and therefore your individual bonus might be a little less. I make a mistake and it costs people's jobs.
Right.
And their extended families might not have income. And I'm not like, oh my God. Like, I'm saying the depth of that and the impact of that is 24/7 on a CEO/entrepreneur. Mm. And it's a difficult thing. I often joke, like, I wouldn't wish that aspect on my worst enemy.
Right. Yeah.
Because
100%.
It's a lot to bear. For people, it's nice to have a big heart combined with really, really, really big shoulders.
Yep. That's
provides a lot of protection.
It's a great sentiment. And I think it does describe entrepreneurship, at least one aspect of it, in a really, you know, nice way, because, you know, the impact that we have extends so far, and the pressure that we hold is pretty extreme, especially when we feel like we're in it alone in the earlier phases of a company or in a smaller company, or even just being the CEO sometimes, right? At some point you are the leader and you might have, you know, a board with a, you know, in your case, a big capital B next to you and your executive team. But at the end of the day, you are the CEO and people are looking to you to make the right decisions in an unprecedented time.
When there's so many oscillating variables and unknowns still, you don't even know what the right answer is. You know what maybe the most right answer is with the current information, but there is no definitive right path yet.
Every leader is going to be comparing notes in 6 months to see once we know what worked best, who was actually doing what worked best.
Yep. Well, hopefully in this day and age of the way information flows and the way people jump on and iterate and imitate and other things like that, it happens faster than that.
Do you talk to a lot of other CEOs, either in media or outside, about your kind of day-to-day decisions or strategies?
I have spoken to more peers in the last 3 weeks, 4 weeks, than I have in the last 2 years.
No way.
100%.
Huh.
And whether it be for guidance on a specific issue, reaching out just to check in, emotional support. And by the way, I mean all of these things on a two-way street. Not that everybody's just, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's been a long time since you realistically, foundationally felt like we are all in this together and it's an all boats rise thing.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
Which is energizing. It reinstates your belief in humanity to a certain degree.
It's fantastic. And I love hearing that. You know, one of the topics I talk about a lot is mental health, because I struggle with it as an entrepreneur. It's one of the core themes of my memoir that's coming out this fall, is the deep, dark levels that I kind of fell down to in trying to run a very high growth tech company while feeling like I was the first and only person to do it and had no support. I felt like I could call on. Now, it was obviously completely false. I was the, you know, 10 millionth person to do it, and I had a ton of people who would have helped me and answered the phone. I just never kind of understood that I had that capability and that longitude to
What time frame was that?
This was, you know, 2000. Well, the company that the book focuses on, my large tech company, was from 2010 to 2015. So, I mean, the company only lasted 5 years. It all went very, very quickly. And from a bootstrap startup to exiting to Salesforce, you know, less than 5 years later.
There's a lot of younger entrepreneurs, and there's also a lot of people who've forgotten how recently in the world that we live in and the sectors we play in, where that was reaching out for help was looked at as weakness.
Sure, right.
And I'm not using that as cover, and I'm definitely not saying it was right, but caring about the mental health of entrepreneurs and leaders and being there for one another and even asking or taking it into consideration is a fairly new phenomenon. A lot of the older dogs in this thing, it is tough to teach them new tricks. I am very impressed with the level of foundational confidence of a lot of the younger entrepreneurs to be so open about their struggles.
Hmm. That's a super interesting, you know, it's kind of perspective on that, because on one hand, I see the world opening up more to us all having our own humanities and being human beings. You're seeing it a lot in the arts and music. You know, it's somewhat acceptable, you know, and the kind of the level of taboo-ness is kind of dropped when a singer or an artist comes out and says, listen, I have a problem and I'm going to either get help or I want to alert my fans or I want support or whatever. It doesn't feel to me like, at least from a public perspective, that's translated over to business and entrepreneurship. It seems like maybe behind closed doors, if you admit to a peer that you're struggling, someone would say, oh, I'm happy to help you, instead of like, well, why the fuck are you calling me? But do you think that that's translated outside of our four walls yet, or will it?
I do. I actually do.
Okay.
And maybe it's my curated network, but I kind of feel that the public conversation on Twitter, on LinkedIn, and I think people are getting very comfortable about being more raw and honest.
How much do you advocate for it? Because there's some people who say we should, like me, I am a massive advocate for being more open, vulnerable, honest, realistic about our own humanities. But others make points that as leaders and as CEOs, we have somewhat of a responsibility to uphold a certain image far more than a pop singer might, in order to maintain people's faith, confidence, etc., no matter what's going on behind closed doors. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
Well, I mean, I'm the wrong person to ask, because I'm a very raw and emotional person, as you see. Like, I'm not, I am who I am on, like, I don't curate my words very often.
Sure.
You know, it's interesting, use the word I kind of loathe. I get the whole point of a CEO or a leader or an entrepreneur wanting to be perceived in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
But you should, I don't think you want to be perceived in a certain image that is not a real one. Be a leader. And by the way, being a leader does not mean that you have no weaknesses. Acknowledging those weaknesses and figuring out how you build your team to support those weaknesses and fill in those holes is big. Being open and honest and transparent with your staff about things you might not be as good at and how you're working through them, I believe, is the definition of being human. And therefore, you get more credibility because you're not lying or positioning or framing to your team something that isn't really foundational. Mm-hmm. If it's not easy for you to get up in front of people and talk, tell them that. And you'd be surprised how people, how different and how much better you get at it.
Right. And this is what I deeply agree with you on that, and what I've been working so hard to reflect on, because, you know, I realized in the years after selling my company, and I went through some shit. I spent some time in some medical recovery. I then moved out of the country for a few years. So I really kind of had to decompress, let's say, after all that. And in reflecting, you know, the big question I asked myself was, it was clearly successful, right? I sold the company, I'm, you know, blah, blah, blah. But was I successful? Was I the right kind of leader? What did I learn? And that's the entire basis of what I now write about and talk about. And I realized that I think I did mostly everything wrong, except for the pure like capitalistic success of the business. I think everything else I pretty much got wrong. And I'm perfectly happy to address and admit that now. And it's interesting to talk to someone like you with such a great kind of perspective on this, because it I think is so validating about how wrong I am, if that makes sense. Like it, I hear you and I'm like, wow, yeah, this is what was so, what should have been so clear for me to see during my time doing that. And people that I know that I've talked to subsequently that are still kind of struggling, like when they hear you say it, it's like, yeah, why don't we all just do that?
You know, in this day and age of social media and gotcha moments and things being taken out of context and outrage culture, I think there's a real lack of fundamental foundational confidence, real confidence, not like peacocking and beating your chest confidence. And you have to have that in order to be able to just put it out there and not be afraid of being taken out of context or someone like, or some outrage or backlash or this or that. And, you know, that comes with experience, man. I don't care how smart you are or how accomplished you are. That's where experience to me makes the biggest difference.
Right.
Going through stuff, learning. I mean, I've made so many mistakes. I'm far from perfect, still very, very far. I'm just more aware than I used to be of not just how I feel, but how other people are feeling. The biggest mistake I see with entrepreneurs is they don't challenge themselves to win every day. They're only looking for that, the big end result.
Right.
And to me, you know, it's like win the battle and win the war.
Right. Right.
And I think that's how you have fun and learn and feel good about the journey as well as the end result.
100%. I agree with you. And that's where, you know, the reflection and, you know, the now work I do on the topic has brought me to. And it's something I want to talk more about, you know, as I go with all my different platforms, because it's important. And it's definitely not as clear cut, I think, to the industry and to entrepreneurship as you're putting it. And that's why it's so important to talk about. So in looking forward, obviously, you know, kind of almost, I don't want to say barring, because we can't bar it, but not putting the pandemic front and center with what's coming up with Complex Networks. I'd love to hear more about kind of what we can expect over the next year. Are there kind of new publications, new shows? It was funny. I'm going to tangent here, Rich. Last week, and this is not, I'm not making this up at all. So I hired these fancy new publicists here in New York to handle all my stuff. And we had our big kickoff meeting last week. And we're going through all the media that they're going to line up for the book and the podcast in the next 6 months and blah, blah, blah. And they asked me what I want to appear on. I am not blowing smoke at all. I go, you know, everything you're mentioning, you know, like the Daily Show and stuff, that's all great. I want to be on Hot Ones. I swear to God.
I know you're going
to. You want to, you know, first of all, it's a great production, whatever. And I also am obsessed with things that are hot. And like I ate the hottest taco in California once. And my picture's on a wall, those kind of things. And then over the weekend, I'm going through the interview prep for this with the producer. And only then do I realize that you guys are behind that. And I'm like, holy shit, right. I'm talking to a celebrity.
Well, you're not I'm far from a celebrity, but you know what that is? What Hot Ones really is? It is IP 3.0.
Yeah.
It is the dream scenario for every publisher / production company / creative from that standpoint. We got very aggressive with our team at the beginning of February.
Mm-hmm.
kind of anticipating this could be the level of problem that we thought it might be. And, you know, we have a lot of our own studios, and I'm like, well, what does it look like? We have no access. And I give so much credit to my creative team. We're launching brand new to world shows in addition to all of the normal shows that we do. There will be 2 to 3 large scale, not iterations, but new to world products and new to world experiences. And I'm using air quotes when I say experiences. You can't see that. But that will be launched in the next 6 months coming from us that have totally come from the challenge of COVID-19, what it presents to us.
Yeah.
And I love that we're using it as a motivator rather than a paralyzer.
Awesome. It's been so great to talk to you. And I know I took a lot of your time, so we'll let you get back to running this this badass company. It's so impressive to hear you speak about this. And I look forward to meeting up, maybe having a beer when we are both back in New York after this pandemic is lessening up.
I would absolutely love it.
That'd be great.
I cannot say thank you enough.
A big thanks to Rich for being on the show. This was an extremely fun chat with a guy who's both older and more mature and somehow younger and cooler than me all at the same time. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe, leave a review, or share with a friend. All of the profits from this limited series will be donated to charities helping people through the pandemic. If you're currently leading from home or looking to talk through something or get some advice as an entrepreneur, I want to hear from you. Head over to roa.com/podcast. That's roa.com/podcast for ways to connect with me. Or hit me on social media at John Roa. It's J-O-H-N-R-O-A. The John Roa Show is a production of iHeartRadio and Roa Media Works. For more podcasts, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. A special thanks to my producers, Jordan Gasporet, here at the show, and Tyler Klang, over at iHeartRadio. We'll be back with you on Monday. In the meantime, stay safe out there.
Days of Halloween. A remote hotel, the most unusual guests, a tour guide that can't be trusted. And the newest arrival is you.
Why are you here again?
They sound like someone you trust.
Trick or treat!
I know you. Can you hear me?
Starring Keegan-Michael Key as the caretaker.
Please make yourself at home. After all, this is it.
One story each night, starting October 19th and ending on Halloween. From iHeartRadio and Blumhouse Television, listen to Aaron Mankey's 13 Days of Halloween on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.